Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Who were the Pinkertons? You may remember them as the relentless hired guns pursuing outlaws in old westerns. But as you'll learn today, the Pinkertons in fact played a critical role in the development of modern American political policing. So please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts. From the Pinkertons to the FBI. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In today's program, we're going to examine the history of the famous Pinkerton National Detective Agency, founded by Alan Pinkerton in 1855. And we'll discuss how the Pinkerton techniques influenced the work of the modern Federal Bureau of Investigation, especially as they relate to the FBI's political activities. To help guide us, we're very fortunate to have with us today the distinguished educator and author Ward Churchill. Professor Churchill taught for many years at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where he was professor of ethnic studies. He's written or edited 22 books and authored over 150 published essays. Today we're going to talk about his paper, From the Pinkertons to the Patriot Act, The Trajectory of Political Policing in the United States, 1870 to Present, which appeared in the spring 2004 issue of the academic journal The New Centennial Review, published by Michigan State University Press. Professor Churchill, thanks very much for joining us on History Counts.
My pleasure.
Who was Alan Pinkerton, and how did he come to establish a detective agency in Chicago in 1855?
Well, actually, he was a political exile and left two steps ahead of the political police in England. Ultimately, he set up shop in Chicago, Illinois, where he worked for a period of time as a policeman, and then ultimately felt it would be more profitable to enter the private sector and hire out services based on skills he'd owned both as a policeman and encountering the repressive apparatus of the British secret police.
Now, his first clients were railroads.
That's correct. He hired out as a railroad detective. In a certain sense, he hired himself out. He was doing actual detective work, or purporting to, at the outset of the Pinkerton Detective Agency once that was established. But he was also hiring people with particular skills that could be of use. For a fee, they would provide services in detection, both in terms of criminal activity, but also in terms of union organizing, or incipient union organizing, both of which were, of course, against the interests of the railroad owners.
From the beginning of his agency, he seemed to have operated in the public as well as the private sector. For example, you tell the story of how in 1861 he was hired to provide security services for President-elect Abraham Lincoln. Can you talk about Pinkerton and the alleged plot to kill Lincoln on the way to Lincoln's inauguration?
Well, I'm not entirely sure he was hired. He appeared on the East Coast. Lincoln had been touring, making whistle stops, if you will, at various points around the country, en route from Illinois to his inauguration in D.C., and he was intercepted by Pinkerton. And Pinkerton asserted that he had uncovered a plot by Copperheads, be Southern sympathizers, to assassinate Lincoln before he was sworn in. He volunteered his services.
And he really took over, didn't he? He persuaded Lincoln to change his schedule.
Took over security. And I'm not sure that he was compensated for that. But it also established his credentials that he was a master sleuth. He was developing an informant network that was nationwide.
This was a great boon to his career, but a congressional investigation conducted shortly thereafter, you write, concluded that there was in fact no conspiracy to assassinate Lincoln.
There's no evidence of one. To all appearances, it was a total hoax, one that really helped to establish his reputation.
And as a result of this fame, he was retained for some lucrative contract by the Union during the Civil War.
Well, yeah, his agency was. He himself received a commission. He was basically an army intelligence, although they didn't yet call it that. He retained people, often Southerners, to become spies on various aspects of Confederate operations. But more importantly, in terms of his own role, he had a counterintelligence function, which was to defeat the capacity of Southern infiltrators, uncover sympathizers who were in positions to do espionage or undermine the morale of the troops.
And following the war, his agency was important enough that the Justice Department actually contracted out services for a new division authorized by Congress for investigation.
Well, the Justice Department was brought into being in that period. It had not existed before that. And then you're talking about an investigative capacity at that point.
So they contracted it to him,
according to Congress, to contract that out to the private sector. It would be what Ronald Reagan would later refer to as privatization,
right.
And then you have the theme that's picked up by Cheney and company to a point where you have privatized armies and such.
He was also working for private business clients, and you say his reputation he would go to any lengths to satisfy the desire of his business clients.
Okay, he's providing security services, enforcement services for essentially the robber barons. Simultaneously, his agency is retained exclusively to the Justice Department, to federal authorities. So you have a confluence there that's very interesting. It defines in a microcosm the relation between the central government of the United States and the major corporate interests of the United States. They're interactive.
One of the private cases you worked on had to do with the Reno Gang, the nation's first train robbers.
Renos were a southern Indiana gang and basically invented train robbery.
The Pinkertons did capture some of the Reno Gang members. And
They captured a couple.
And they were taking them by train, right? Presumably to be imprisoned, but something happened on the way to the prison. Can you talk about
that? Yeah, they were intercepted by a gang of irate citizens. That's the story.
Some suggestion that the Pinkertons actually abandoned them to the, shall we say, vigilantes?
Well, there's a suggestion of more than that in Alan Pinkerton's memoirs. He basically, to all intents and purposes, admit that the operatives, people retained for that purpose, were utilized to impersonate a vigilante mob. It functioned as a vigilante mob, but it wasn't actual vigilantes in the sense that this is an organic outgrowth of citizen sentiment in the area. The citizen sentiment is exactly the opposite.
Basically, the so-called vigilantes were actually set up, organized by the Pinkertons.
Yeah, he created what would, in 20th century parlance, be known as a pseudo-gang. These people were not who they were reported to be.
So the gang members were lynched instead of being put on trial.
But on threat of lynching, they divulged information on the gang members who had not been caught.
So that led to more arrests.
Yeah.
And then I understand.
In fear of lynching, they divulged the information, then they were lynched and were thus effectively neutralized. They weren't going to be robbing trains anymore. They're dead, and there's been a message that's being sent there.
And that was a very big part of it. To show to his clients he'd go to any lengths in order to fulfill their interests.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to the James Younger gang, because the Reno case brought a lot of publicity. Pinkertons were hired by an Iowa bank to catch the James Younger gang. Could you talk about the tactics they used against that gang, including the hiring of Bob Ford?
Well, the Pinkertons were retained essentially by a consortium, railroad consortium. There were banks involved, and ultimately the government of Missouri was involved. The Pinkertons themselves were not successful. They created essentially a sort of guerrilla war down there. They killed the wrong people. They blew Jesse James' mother's arm off, killed his infirm younger brother, and a number of other things. So essentially the Pinkerton operation itself galvanized sentiment even more strongly in support of the James Younger group than had been the case before they started. So formal Pinkerton operation was abandoned at a certain point. Pinkerton himself, acting in his capacity with the Pinkerton Agency and as his expert, maintains a consultancy with the governor of the state of Missouri. And the ultimate solution to the problem, and this is a technique recommended by Pinkerton, is that two infiltrators, the Ford brothers, were paid $10,000 to get close to Jesse James and assassinate him. Bob Ford shot him from very close range in the back of the head. They were then paid the $10,000. So simply executing summary execution of the target assassination murder is a technique, clearly on the Pinkerton inventory of techniques for neutralizing targets and successfully concluding operations.
And you're right that the Pinkertons also conducted extensive anti-labor operations using similar techniques on behalf of the... Could you talk about the Molly Maguires? Who were the Molly Maguires, and what kind of operations did the Pinkertons, especially I'm thinking of James McParland and Robert Lyndon, conduct against the Molly Maguires?
Well, the Molly Maguires, first off, were a secret society. It was part of the Irish Resistance.
And we're talking about the anthracite coal mines in the northeastern Pennsylvania.
Where they're engaged in the mining, but the mine owners there are essentially of the same mentality as the British overlords from the islands they left.
And there was this confluence. The Reading Railroad hauled the coal, but they also were the largest coal mine owners.
Yeah, and they owned the towns, and in fact, they were the police, and they were, Pinkertons sometimes provided police, but they had their own police force, and they had the courts.
As I understand it, James McParland infiltrated the group.
He went to work in the mines. He was sent in.
He's an operative.
He's a Pinkerton operative, and his mission, his assignment, was to infiltrate the Molly Maguires and get as close as possible to Jack Kehoe, who was considered to be the leader of the group. He did get close to Kehoe. He was a key member in fairly short order of the Molly leadership. And so he began to act as an agent provocateur. This is yet another tactic that's part of the contemporary. All of these are incorporated into the inventory of techniques supplied for domestic counterintelligence purposes still today. I mean, they find their roots, their application, their initial development right here. What McParland would do would be to propose an operation, a dynamiting operation, for example. He would also secure the dynamite and provide the plan. And he ran one of these initially that essentially was complete setup. He took the group to the site. He had provided the dynamite. He had selected the site. He had selected the time. He had selected the date. He explained the reason why they had accepted it. And then there were guards, company police, deployed in the area, which several of them got killed, the rest arrested.
And so he became a witness then at the trial.
Yeah. After that, he surfaced. Okay, you had this sensational incident, and they used that then to round up the Mollies. He could identify all of them, and he provided the key testimony. A judicial process of a sort was followed, but it was staffed by, run by, the company, the corporation.
You're right that Robert Lyndon led the posse that made the arrest. It wasn't a bunch of sheriffs.
The whole thing. The town was built by the coal company. Okay, everybody that lived in the town were workers for the coal company. The police of the town worked for the company. The court was run by the company.
Yeah, you mentioned that the prosecutor was not a government official, but a Reading Railroad official.
Well, so was the judge. Yeah, I'm talking about it. When I say corporate operation, I mean literally that. This was literally a component of the corporation.
They hung virtually the entire leadership.
Yeah, hanging as a result. Jack Kehoe and several others.
So 20 of them went to the gallows.
Yeah.
So this was yet another technique, which is the mass arrest. You arrest the whole leadership of a union or a political group, and you can really break it that way.
There are several variations. This was one, using an agent provocateur to instigate a criminal action. Okay, for which the evidence is obviously in hand because the provocateur is a cop and he's the person who's putting the operation together. Then you have incriminating evidence, so you can take these people out on the basis of an actual criminal enterprise, but one they would not in all likelihood have engaged in had it not been for the instigation of the police. So you're creating this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. Usually it's not conducted in quite as raw a manner as the Molly trial. Usually you have a little more sophistication in confusing the issue with the interplay between public officials and private actors.
An example of this you cite is that the Pennsylvania governor could issue special commissions at the request of coal and iron companies, giving Pinkertons and other employees police powers. So essentially they could automatically deputize these private security guards.
Yeah, they were carrying badges well into the 20th century, something on the order of 30,000 commissions that were issued that effectively turned corporate personnel into agents of the state. They're still working for the corporation and taking their instruction there, but they're covered under the mantle of state authority. So you had 30,000 odd corporate thugs who were deputized to receive state sanction to control labor by the means that you see in old movies. And they're using riot batons, or using riot shotguns, or using tear gas. At some points, they're using machine guns. You had an entire army created literally an army, and it was advertised as such, that would hire out during labor disturbances in order to put down strikers.
In fact, you quote the New York Times called the Pinkertons, quote, a mercenary army, end quote.
Yeah, there were a number of these outfits. Pinkerton's simply the most prominent and, over the long term, influential.
And the Pinkertons actually served in important public positions. For example, Robert Linden of the Molly Maguire fame was superintendent of Pinkerton's Philadelphia office and later became head of the Philadelphia Police Department. And you also mentioned another fellow, George Doherty, a Pinkerton veteran, became New York City's chief of detectives in 1911.
You have a regular retention of people who have made their bones in the private sector, and they're hired for particular purposes, sometimes overall commander, as in the case of Linden, chief of police. The lines are permeable. They're continuously interactive. You find that with the Bureau of Investigation, which becomes the FBI.
The FBI itself is started in 1935, and you show how the first FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, utilized many of the Pinkerton techniques.
I mean, in part, the rationale for starting the actual government bureau in the Justice Department is to sever relations with enterprises like Pinkerton. And the government would then develop its own capacity to investigate violation of federal law. But all of the personnel are drawn from the detective agency, so there you have it. You change the title, but it's the same people, and J. Edgar Hoover really pursued that.
And you see it particularly during the FBI's COINTEL program against the political dissidents in the 50s through the 70s. And one of the Pinkerton techniques used by the FBI was the apparent fabrication of terrorist threats. Could you talk about Hoover's 1970 testimony before Congress about the alleged conspiracy to assassinate Henry Kissinger?
Oh, yeah. He testified that the FBI had uncovered a plot by Mary Knoll nuns and two Jesuit priests, the Berrigan brothers, to stage a military coup that would devolve upon the assassination of Henry Kissinger because of their opposition to the war. And there was going to be sabotage to the tunnels under Washington, D.C. that are effective for the security of government officials and a number of other components. He got a big budget increase out of this, and it was written up quite sensationally in the press. It turned out to be vacuous. There was no basis for a prosecution. In fact, I'm not quite sure they ever even arrested anyone out of that. He simply gave a very vivid, detailed account of something that didn't exist.
Well, another technique.
But it shaped public impression. So they had this big splash about how dangerous the anti-war people were as a result of Hoover's testimony, and then it became apparent that there was nothing to it at all.
But it served its purpose.
Yeah, nobody remembered it. What they recall was that there was this assassination plot, and these are violence-prone people. Every one of the people involved in the group that Hoover was talking about was a devout pacifist. He was seeking to discredit people who had a very high degree of credibility. Pretty broad section of the population at the time, because of their pacifism, because of their religious backgrounds and so forth. And he was seeking to discredit that, so he simply lied straight face.
The FBI also created vigilante groups like Pinkerton to carry out acts of violence against supposed enemies. In 1969-70, the FBI created and financed a group known as the Secret Army Organization. Could you talk about the activities of the Secret Army Organization?
Well, it was an extreme right-wing organization that they put a couple of operatives into in order to give some direction and shape. They amassed arms and they carried out, literally, terrorist actions against selected left-wing targets. They attempted to assassinate a Marxist economics professor named Peter Bulmer in an L.A. suburb one night. Missed him, shattered his companion's arm, and permanently disabled her. That was a sniper SAO under direction of the FBI. And it was to send a message to other left-leaning faculty members that they too could be targeted. So it was intended to have this
right.
Killing effect. That's what terrorism is about. They also were responsible for burning of the community theater that was used by the left in L.A. and a number of other actions. Ultimately, their utility apparently was used up, and their arms caches were uncovered and so forth. They had a massive arsenal. They were basically to be a counterforce utilized in the repression of the California leftists.
And, of course, this is during the Vietnam War. Now, could you talk about the FBI operative during the same period, known as Tommy the Traveler?
Tommy Tongye. actually worked for a couple of state police departments as well as the FBI up in the New England area. And he then drove around in a truck impersonating an SDS member from another state, going from campus to campus, hooking up with the local SDS chapters, and basically in the same manner as McParland and the Molly Maguires. You guys aren't serious. Your opposition isn't serious. You need to bomb the ROTC building, firebomb the thing tonight.
This is the classic echelon provocateur.
Yeah.
And he was tied to the bombing of a ROTC facility at Hobart College.
Yeah, there were a couple of other comparable incidents. And when the people would show up, carry out the action, they would be arrested and Tommy would be in the truck heading for the next campus. It was a campaign to take out people they felt were effective organizers in the student milieu in these campuses. So there's a neutralization occurring in that sense, but it also fit into a broader propaganda campaign to discredit.
Now, the idea of taking out leadership was very important in the mass arrests in 1973 at the South Dakota Pine Ridge Reservation. Could you talk about that?
And it was a struggle over right to self-determination was going on, an attempt to replace the federally installed tribal government with one that was actually reflecting of the people's interest rather than the federal interest. And the flashpoint comes then at Wounded Knee in early 1973. As a result of that, Russell Means, who was one of the more prominent leaders and on the reservation, he came out at Wounded Knee facing 40 felonies and three misdemeanors with a cumulative potential sentence of lifetimes, three plus 87 years, and ultimately none of them were sustained. Federal authorities filed well over 400 felony charges against members of the American Indian Movement coming out of Wounded Knee. They got 15 convictions. And representative of that is interference with a postal inspector in the process of official duties. That was the lowest rate of prosecutorial success in the history of the U.S. Justice Department. But there was no hope of conviction on it, and that wasn't their object.
So the real object is to break the movement.
Sure. You bankrupted mounting bail and legal defense, okay, and you tie the people who were key to doing the political organizing up in legal defense of themselves to stay out of prison. Or they're sitting in cells waiting for trial. They're thoroughly neutralized, and that's the object.
I wanted to talk about the Black Panthers because they seemed to be a group during this late 60s period of COINTELPRO that was particularly the target of Pinkerton-type techniques. For example, infiltrators, you write 30 FBI infiltrators got into the Black Panthers.
Well, that's at a minimum. Those are people who have been identified.
The FBI attempted to foment, or actually did foment, a bloody battle between the Black Panthers and another black nationalist group by disinformation, disseminating forged cartoons. Could you talk about that?
That's with the so-called United Slaves, the US organization. According to the FBI's internal documents, they had assessed each group as being violence-prone, and so they put out these cartoons, one in the name of the other, in a graphic style that would be, in some sense, reflective of the graphic style that's attributed to the group, so that they're insulting each other in the most vicious sorts of ways. This results in two of the key Panther leaders in Los Angeles, John Huggins and Bunchy Carter, being murdered. Okay, turns out that a couple of the guys that were the trigger men in that job were FBI infiltrators into us. The key is that Richard Wallace Held, who was on the COINTELPRO desk for the FBI, the Panther Squad, in L.A. at the time, sends a memo immediately after the Huggins-Carter murders pointing to the success of the operation and recommending it be continued on that basis. And so then you have a guy by the name of Sylvester Bill, who is a Black Panther in San Diego, a few months later gets shot to death on a street corner by gunmen who are part of the US organization. And once again, there's the recommendation that based upon the success of the operation, it should be continued.
Finally, could you talk about the killing of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, the FBI's involvement in Chicago on 4th of December, 1969?
Yeah, that's an outright assassination. The federal authorities, J. Edgar Hoover, had shortly before declared the Black Panther Party, which was at the time about 5,000 members strong, to be the most significant internal security threat to the United States, bar none. And this is probably the most substantial leader that the Panthers had on the street at the time. So in that particular case, they had co-opted an individual that was facing federal charges, a guy by the name of O'Neill. We won't prosecute you on the federal charges if you infiltrate the Black Panther Party. And this will sound familiar, remembering McParland's infiltration activities. Get as close to Fred Hampton as you can. Well, McNeil became an aide, bodyguard, whatever, in direct proximity to Fred Hampton. At a certain point, he meets with one of his handlers, an agent, Piper, at a restaurant near downtown Chicago, and draws a floor plan to Hampton's apartment, complete with the placement of furniture and indicating the bed that Hampton slept in. The FBI then arranged for a special squad of state's attorney's police to run an arms raid on the apartment pre-dawn rather than going in daylight. They checked out a machine gun before they went on this raid. Now, O'Neill, the infiltrator, was in the apartment that night. Hampton taught a class near north side of Chicago. Most of the Panthers that were staying in the apartment had accompanied Hampton to that. O'Neill prepared dinner while they were gone, so they came back from Fred's teaching this class. Dinner's ready. With the meal, Kool-Aid was served, and O'Neill had spiked Fred's glass of Kool-Aid with cyclobarbital, massive dose, so that when the raiders kick in the door at 4 in the morning, 4:30 actually, Fred's in a coma. He's not asleep. He's a stationary target on the bed, exactly where he's supposed to be, which then allowed one of the raiders, Carmody, I think, who was in possession of the machine gun. They went in shooting. They shot up the place. They hit several Panthers. Fred never woke up. Carmody steps up to the wall, on which he knew immediately on the other side of the wall is where Fred's bed's going to be, and he just took the machine gun and ran it the length of the wall, shot through the wall, hit him in his bed. Wasn't mortal wounded. So two of the raiders go into his bedroom, shooting twice in the head. One had asked the other, that's Fred Hampton, is he dead? And the other one says, no, looks like he's going to make it. And then there's a thump as his body's dragged from the bed onto the floor. Two shots, which turn out to have been fired at point-blank range, into his head. And the voice that's heard by the Panthers on the other side of the door, well, he's good and dead now.
And what was the effect on the Black Panther movement?
By 1972-73, the Black Panther Party and its galvanizing effect on the population was over, and it had dissolved into warring factions, fragmented. That was the intent of the operation.
Professor Churchill, thanks very much for being with us today. You're listening to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with Professor Ward Churchill about the history of the Pinkerton Detective Agency and its influence on the modern Federal Bureau of Investigation. And I'll be back in a moment. The similarities between the Pinkertons and the FBI did not end with police tactics. To promote his detective agency, Alan Pinkerton published a series of ghost-written books with titles like Mississippi Outlaws and the Detectives, and Strikers, Communists, Tramps, and Detectives, featuring sensational accounts of his operatives' exploits. Taking this cue from Pinkerton, J. Edgar Hoover established an FBI public relations department called the Crime Records Division. FBI writers there developed stories celebrating FBI successes, glamorizing its agents, and alerting Americans to the threat within. These stories appeared in books, magazines, and even movies. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs, see a schedule of upcoming shows, and sign up for our monthly newsletter and podcasts. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.